Good day, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Bayless Asset Management Quarter Four Investor Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Bryan Smith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Alicia. Welcome, everyone, to the Bayless Asset Management Quarterly Investor Call. Our guest speaker today is Bayless founder, CIO, and portfolio manager, Regan Stanky. Regan has over 20 years of experience in the financial service industry, spanning from early-stage investing startups to public equities. Before starting Bayless Asset Management, Regan was senior portfolio manager of the SMID Value and SMID Plus products at Westwood Management. Regan joined Westwood in 2004 and was responsible for managing and growing the SMID and SMID Plus products to over $4 billion. During his management of SMID Value, the portfolio had a 10-year track record that ranked in the top 10% against its respective peer group. Regan was also a member of the Portfolio Risk Committee and Business Management Committee at Westwood. Regan started his career with Arthur Andersen in the Business Valuation Group and later with the research group at UBS Investment Bank in New York. While at UBS, he spent 3 years as a research analyst focused on the software industry and later promoted to associate director, where he served on the U.S. strategy equity team. Regan holds his CFA charter and graduated from the University of Texas at Austin with a BA in economics. For the performance, Bayless SMID Value quarter four returned 4.9%. The Russell 2500 value benchmark returned 6.3%. For the year calendar 2021, the Bayless composite portfolio returned 40.4% compared to the Russell 2500 value of 27.7%. So let's get started. Regan, to kick things off, maybe talk about the current headwinds in the financial markets in terms of inflation, supply chain issues, Fed interest rate policy, and maybe comment on how your strategy has performed both historically and recently in these periods of volatility.
Sure. Thank you, Brian. You know, I want to kick off the call from my perspective by reflecting on a quote I think is profound and more appropriate today than it has been since 2007, and that's that it's not a stock market, but a market of stocks. And I think that is really important to consider when you get in periods of time like today, when you've got so many different concerns within the market. And as you mentioned, you know, inflation, interest rates, the Fed. I know that I'm sure every sell-side strategist on the planet has written something on this over the last month or so, and it's on CNBC every day. So I won't spend a whole lot of time. But I do want to get into a couple of things that I think everyone should consider on each of those. The first, in terms of inflation, we really think about it in two parts. First is the inflation that we're feeling because of disruptions in the global supply chain. And that's what the Fed has been pointing to is why they believe inflation is transitory. And to a large extent, from a supply chain perspective, I think they're probably right. And you know, what we're feeling today, and the reason inflation has gotten worse, is when largely because of China's zero COVID policy, in which they have taken extreme measures to clamp down on the spread of COVID, and that's led to shutting down factories for periods of time. And as we talk to our companies, that's exactly what they experienced in the fourth quarter. And so that likely gets sorted out this year. Probably much of it will get sorted out by the middle of the year. And those inflationary pressures will start to go away. The things to consider as that's happening is the difference between companies that are seeing delayed sales versus lost sales as a result of that. And so think of toys at Christmas versus telecom equipment for 5G, which if you miss buying the toys at Christmas, you're probably just not going to buy those again until next year. And a ROADM for 5G implementation is going to be necessary whether it gets bought today or 6 months from now. The other part of inflation I think is less well understood, although I am starting to read more about this, is energy inflation, which we believe is semi-permanent. And semi-permanent by it's will likely exist until we get through this transition from carbon-based energy production, electricity production, to renewable at whatever level we as a planet decide is appropriate. And just to give you an idea of why we think this is that if you just look at the fundamentals, we had about 900 drilling rigs operating in at the end of 2018. Today, we have 500. In 2018, natural gas was 250. Today, it's 450. Oil was roughly 70 bucks. Today, it's in the mid-90s. And the reason we think that's unlikely to change very quickly is because there's been a massive shift in demand for energy stocks, especially amongst large institutional allocators, many of which, for a variety of reasons, mostly tied to ESG, have decided to not invest in energy companies anymore. And that is increasing the cost of capital. In addition, investors that are still investing in energy are requiring these companies to generate free cash flow. And that the result of that is that production growth has been and will likely continue to be slower than we experienced for the better part of the last decade or two. And so at the end of the day, it's not just the prices of the hydrocarbons, but you're going to likely see that remain elevated and get passed through. And then also the capital that's being allocated to renewables and the rate of return required on that capital. And so that energy, whether it's just, you know, the electricity in your house or how energy perpetuates through everything that we consume is likely to stay elevated in our mind probably for the next decade or so. And so that's just something to we think that's important to consider. The other thing as it relates to the Fed and interest rates, you know, we don't know whether the Fed's going to raise rates 5 times this year, 7 times, 9 times, whether it's going to be 50 basis points each time or 25. What we are convicted about is that the Fed is under enormous pressure to get inflation under control. And as we get closer to the midterm elections, that pressure is likely to rise even more. And so what does that mean? Number one, that means that they're going to raise interest rates. And number two, they're going to shrink their balance sheet, i.e. less liquidity and less demand for treasuries. And so where that ends, who knows? We've seen in the last 3 or 4 months, the 2-year has jumped 135 basis points. That's an enormous increase, and it tells you what the bond market thinks, and i.e. that the Fed is going to be pretty aggressive in getting rates up. So what does all of that mean? Number one, it means that multiples on stocks are coming down. And by and large, multiple expansion is what drives growth markets. I'm using growth in quotes here. So what we've experienced over the last decade. The other thing it means is that companies are going to be allowed to fail again, that the Fed put is gone. Right? And so balance sheets will matter, and companies' ability to finance themselves, self-finance, are going to matter. Those that have been getting by on cheap debt are likely to struggle. And the last thing that it means is that current cash flows are going to matter much more than future cash flows. And that's something that we haven't seen in large part since the previous business cycle, the 02 through 07 business cycle. And so in terms of the current environment, and what we're seeing, about 2/3 of our companies, a little more, have reported earnings so far. And by and large, what the management teams are saying is that demand is strong, and in many cases, it's actually accelerating. Costs are going up, and whether that's labor, shipping, materials, and that the supply chain problems are preventing growth that they believe would be even faster without those supply chain problems. So that what it does, it gives them more conviction and visibility into their revenue and earnings outlooks going throughout the year, because their backlog and bookings are increasing in many instances much faster than their sales are actually increasing. And so it gives us more confidence in those numbers. And so given everything that that I've just said on whether, you know, inflation rates, multiples, et cetera, you know, how are we positioned for that environment? A couple of different things. Number one, we own companies with pricing powers, with pricing power that are able to pass along these increased costs in terms of higher prices and make any either maintain margins or even expand margins in many instances. We had a CEO of one of our companies that reported yesterday that, that said they're not a shock absorber for inflation, and that's exactly the kind of businesses that we want to own. The second thing is that we buy businesses that generate cash flow, specifically free cash flow. And what that means is that they're able to self-fund their growth and not rely on either the capital markets or the debt markets in order to achieve their targets. The last thing is that we think is going to be extremely important going forward is that we rely on earnings and cash flow growth, not multiple expansion, in order for our companies to hit our price target. And I want to give you a couple of examples of what I mean here. There's two companies that reported yesterday. One we own, one we don't, but I just found this interesting. One was Huntsman Chemicals. And this is a boring chemical company down in Houston. They make a number of different specialty chemicals. One of the primary ones is a chemical that is used in the spray foam that's for insulation inside of homes that is growing massive market share. But again, a pretty boring business. We bought it about 3 years ago. It's up over 100% since we bought it. But what's interesting about that is that the multiple is effectively unchanged. We bought it for around 6x EBITDA, and it's trading at about 6.5x EBITDA today. So the vast majority of the upside in the stock just came from earnings growth and cash accumulating on the balance sheet. I'll contrast that to a company that you may have heard of. Certainly, you've heard of the what's going on in the end markets, which is Monolithic Power Systems. And they make electrical components that go into everything from handsets to one of the obviously the big drivers today is electric vehicles, you know, computers, storage systems, et cetera. And so over the exact same time frame, that stock is up about 200%. So if you look at just the performance, you would say, well, you should have owned that stock over Huntsman. But what I will tell you is that during that time frame, the multiple expanded from 28x EBITDA up to 40x EBITDA. And so a big chunk of the stock performance was purely through multiple expansion. And they grew revenue, to be clear, but that was a big part of it. Now, what's interesting about this company is that prior to what I'll call the growth rally of effectively the last decade. So if you look at, call it 2011, 12, and 13, this company traded at 15x EBITDA. And so from today, what that means is that even if they just continue hitting the sell side numbers, but the multiple comes down because of rates, inflation, et cetera, that you've got about 60% downside risk just because of multiple compression. Another example that is even more extreme, this is one of my favorites. We own a company called Teradata that competes with a company called Snowflake. And Snowflake, at the end of this year, calendar 22, will have about the same revenue, if the analysts are right, as Teradata does, or will have at the same time. Snowflake has never made any money, but the street thinks that they'll make around $80 million in EBITDA this year. Teradata on that same revenue number will make something closer to $500 million. And so the difference between the two companies is not just the profitability, and Snowflake is growing faster, much faster at the moment. The street thinks that they'll grow a little over 60% this year to get to that $2 billion revenue number. But for Snowflake, you're paying 1,000x EBITDA, 2022, and Teradata is 11.5x. Now, these companies, again, effectively do the same thing. It's data analytics. And so just to put that into perspective, that if Snowflake continues to grow at the rate the street thinks it will in 2022, so a little over 60%, it'll take them 7 years to get to a revenue number, assuming they have the same margins as Teradata, that they can ultimately turn that profitability. So it's going to take them 7 years to get to an EBITDA number that would give them the same multiple that Teradata has today. And that gets them to revenue of about somewhere around $35 billion. So just to put that into perspective, going from $1 billion in 2021 to $35 billion, it took Oracle almost 20 years to do that. SAP going from $1 billion, they're still not at $35 billion. It took Microsoft 15 years. These are global IT staples, for lack of a better word. And what you're inherently saying is that in order for Snowflake to be at fair value, they're going to have to grow faster than three of the best brands in global IT, twice as fast. That's kind of the things that we're most concerned with as we think about rates going up as a result of inflation, is that that's an enormous headwind to face, and one that we haven't faced since the dot-com bubble. And frankly, that's the last time we saw the valuation differential between small cap value and large cap growth this big. And so, just again, putting it in perspective, Teradata on $500 million in EBITDA is a $5.5 billion company. Snowflake is a $90 billion company on what should effectively be the same sales. And so we can get into, and I'm happy to ask or answer more questions on that as we get past that, but that's the real headwind that I think that the market overall, especially on the growth side, is gonna face this year. The last thing that I'll mention in terms of how we're positioned for this is that we own companies with clean balance sheets in case the Fed gets it wrong, and that's how we're going to protect our investors. Overall, our companies have zero net debt in aggregate, and if you look at the 2500 value, it's about three times net debt to EBITDA. And so during times of market dislocation, that's one of the ways that we've been able to protect investors and avoid a significant chunk of the downside in the market, is by owning companies that have clean balance sheets, good returns, and where we have a firm understanding of the downside risk in the business for risks that we can't anticipate. So, Brian, I'll pause right there to see if there's any questions on any of that or anything else.
Sure, Alicia, can we open up the phone lines for questions, please?
We have a question from the line of Charles Engelbert of Engelbert Financial.
All right, good morning. Hey, guys, thanks much. Presentation on the drivers of inflation, very concise, and you kind of crystallized it for me. So, my thesis as to why I think your area is going to be very exciting in the next couple of years has been, number one, the incredible outperformance of large cap growth stocks, i.e. the FANGs, for so long that, I think, we saw it in January that all the money is going to start to come out of the FANGs and look for, the law of large numbers and look for, other asset classes to be in. And the small mid asset class area has underperformed for so long, it almost reminds me of the emerging markets in the 80s when they would do 1 year of 67% and then do nothing for another 10 years. But I guess my question is, I'm looking for the catalysts, that's really going to drive this particular asset class. I think it's going to be, all the, pent up money in large cap growth looking for another home as large cap growth underperforms. But I'm just looking to see if you guys have any additional thoughts or comments.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think the catalyst is what we're seeing right now is rates. And it literally, whether it's, from a financial perspective, what rising interest rates means is that the cost of capital is going up, and therefore the a discount rate in your sort of DCF, discounted cash flow model, is going higher, and therefore future cash flows are worth less than current cash flows, and that that discount rate on those cash flows works the exact same way as compounding does on performance, right? It's not linear, it's logarithmic. And so as investors consider, you know, a company like Snowflake making $500 million several years out, that's dramatically less valuable than a company that's producing that today. And so I think, I mean, if you look at the peak in the market back in November the 8th, it coincides directly with the interest rate starting to rise. And then it it really started spiraling once Powell spoke in front of the Congress and admitted that inflation was, you know, that they was not transitory, at least in the terms of how he had been talking about it in the past, i.e. that it was going to be here for a while and that he was going to have to, that they were going to have to get that under control. And so, that was the catalyst, I believe. And you know, once that starts, you know, happening, and you can look at some of the very popular ETFs that own many of these companies, that's exactly what they're experiencing. The companies are still growing revenue and to the extent that they were generating earnings, growing earnings. It's the multiples that are compressing, and that's what's causing a shift out of large cap growth into small and mid cap value. And we don't think that that's a couple of month process. We think that, you know, if you look at the 02 through 07 cycle after the last time we got to this big of a distortion between large cap growth and small cap value, that played out over the next 5 to 6 years. And it wouldn't surprise us if that's exactly what we're going to see this time around.
Reagan, one last area I'd like for you to comment on is just kind of, let's talk about downside and you know, the protection there kind of with value stocks. And can you speak a little bit to how you underwrite potential companies, your upside downside scenarios and how that process works with you and your team?
Absolutely. So if you look over we've managed this strategy for about 18 years now. And over that period of time, our downside capture tends to be 65 to 70%. And that was consistent with what we've experienced in this current downdraft since November the 8th. And so the ability to avoid a big chunk of the drawdown in the market is what we believe is critical in compounding returns over time. I mean, it's just sort of stating the obvious, right? But when you find yourself in a hole, the best first thing you want to do is quit digging. And so the way we do that is by putting an enormous amount of effort on the front end before we ever buy a stock in asking ourselves, the first question we ask is, when we're wrong, how much money are we going to lose? And we actually quantify that in terms of a downside price target. And we will use sort of anything and everything at our disposal in order to come up with a firm downside price target, whether it's the liquidation value of a company, some of the parts analysis, whether it's a literally selling all of the real estate as a retailer. We've looked at shipping companies. We said, if we just sold all of the ships as scrap steel, what's it worth? And so these, you know, if it's a cyclical, what is the trough multiple that it's this either company or this industry has ever gone to? So these are truly, you know, draconian type outlooks, and apply that. And we're looking to buy companies within 20 to 30% of that downside. And so that's what has enabled us to consistently outperform during times of market dislocation, whether it was the great financial crisis in 07 and 08, when the Fed started raising rates and draining liquidity back in 18, the market was down 12% on that. We were down 2. The global pandemic, again, we outperformed there. And so the reason we're able to consistently do that over and over and over again is because of our reliance on the downside analysis. And then the other thing that I will mention is that when we buy a stock, we are looking for asymmetry in that upside versus downside of at least 3 to 1. So if our downside is 30%, we need our upside to be at least 100%. And what we're doing is relying on that asymmetry to turn alpha generation into a manufacturing process. And so what we're just, instead of relying on our ability to be right on companies over and over again, we just want to be extraordinarily consistent in applying that 3-to-1 reward to risk ratio and saying that, you know, even if we're only right with a coin flip, we'll still generate alpha because we make at least 3 times as much when we're right as we lose when we're wrong. And so that's why over that same 18 years, our upside capture is about 110 to 115% versus a downside capture of 65 to 70. And that's what has allowed us to outperform over a long period of time.
Great. Very helpful. Thank you. Alicia, are there any more questions?
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from the line of Matt Dennis, a private investor.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
We can.
Thanks, Reagan. Thanks for the update. Just to follow up, appreciate the comments around kind of interest rates and pricing power and leverage and other within the portfolio. I'm curious if you could speak to the mix of exposures within the portfolio currently and how you would expect the portfolio to perform should economic growth either disappoint this year or come in better than expected.
Sure. Great questions. So a couple of things. As I think of mix, one of the ways, and I'm often asked about this, and you know, it's easy enough to identify what sectors we're in, but I think a more important way of thinking about mix is thinking about businesses that have recurring revenue versus businesses that you know, sell a product that, you know, if you sell a piece of semicap equipment this year for $100 million, you got to sell another piece for $100 million next year just to stay even, right? And so one of the things that is, I think, somewhat unique about our portfolio is that the vast majority of these businesses have recurring revenue to them. And so this speaks to what I think your question about, you know, the Fed getting it wrong and actually affecting the economy, right? And so having that support from the recurring revenue is what enables us to have conviction in our downside analysis. But the flip side of that is, and we wrote about this in our annual letter, that we think that the risk reward on the portfolio as a whole, not just any individual stock, is greater than 3-to-1, and that the upside to the portfolio is about 150% to our price targets. And so what that means is that, you know, if the Fed doesn't screw it up, and if we're able to continue to grow and have economic expansion coming out of this restart period, that we think that there's material upside in the companies that we own. That answer your question?
Yeah, no, that's good. Maybe a follow-on if I could. So you spoke to kind of the net leverage within the portfolio, but presumably that's geared more towards the non-financials that you hold. The small
Sure.
cap space, small cap value, typically a large number of financials. Can you just talk about the financial exposure you have and kind of the leverage within those portfolio holdings in financials specifically, were we to see meaningful dislocation in yield curves?
Meaningful dislocation, i.e. the yield curve inverts, is that what you're asking?
Exactly, yeah.
Sure. So a couple of things. Number one, we are pretty materially underweight financials, and within financials, even more so in banks. We had taken a pretty significant position back in during the COVID lockdown and have sold a number of positions that just because they either got too big or hit price targets. A handful of banks that we still own today, they are very asset sensitive, and so we'll perform better in a rising rate environment. But they also have some very unique characteristics. And I'll just give you a quick example. One company called Capital Bank is out of D.C. It's a traditional bank in many ways, but they, in addition to their traditional banking, i.e. commercial, industrial, and housing, they have a credit card that is 100% secured, right? And so, you know, in order to get $1,000 of credit, you have to deposit $1,000. And they charge the same fees as any Visa or MasterCard, but again, it's 100% secured. So you ask yourself, well, why wouldn't I just use a debit card if I'm going to do that? Well, the reason is because you don't build credit with a debit card. You have to have a credit card in order to build credit. And so for many people either that are trying to rebuild their credit or just don't have any credit, this offers them a way to do it, and it offers banks a way to be protected. And so what you're seeing there is the returns on that business are, on that specific piece of business, are about 5x traditional bank. And that's the fastest growing piece of that. And so it's a way that we can have exposure in a rising rate environment to something that should benefit, but it also gives us the protection that a traditional bank doesn't have. And the other thing I will mention is that within the financials, we have a significant weight in insurance and also some mortgage REITs the insurers, mortgage insurers. In insurance, what we're seeing is specifically in property and casualty, it's the hardest market that we've seen in our career, and going back, you know, 20 or 30 years. And hard market, that's a terminology in the space to mean pricing is as high as it's been in 20 years or so. And so we think that our financials exposure specifically offers us some asset sensitivity or some exposure to asset sensitivity, but there's some very specific company drivers that we believe will work almost in spite of what the yield curve does.
That's great. Appreciate the call.
Yep, no worries.
Well, great. We'll wrap it up there. Reagan, thank you so much. Very insightful as always. Very strong performance 2021. Great job by you and the team. Thank you, everyone, for joining. We will send a replay of the call out over the next 7 to 10 days. We appreciate your participation and look forward again to speaking with you next quarter. Thank you.